So welcome. So in the last lecture, 2 days ago, I showed you the how you can define or construct, at least you know, in a physicist way, a generalization of path integral for quantizing the scalar scalar free field, so the Klein-Gordon field. And I showed that you can compute by this functional integral formalism, you can easily derive the form of the propagator, namely the correlation, the two field correlation function, and show that it agrees with the result of canonical quantization. So at least for the two-point function, the two procedures give the same result. Okay. So today I'm going to continue to discuss a bit the properties of the free field that you can easily derive through path integral quantization or functional quantization. And then if I have time, I'll start to deal with the interacting theory, but it will just be an introduction. So what I'm planning to do, I'm still considering the free field. And so the first things we want to do, but that's something that you have seen already, is to go from the two-point function to general correlation function. And in fact, you have seen in canonical quantization and also in the quantum theory course on the example of quantum mechanics that this requires a fundamental result, which is the Wick theorem. So I'm just going very shortly to show how it works, but you are supposed to have seen that already. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that I'm going to discuss in more detail the properties of the two-point function, so the propagator, at short and large distances. That's something probably you have already discussed in quantum mechanics, in a statistical physics course from the point of view of statistical physics. But that's very important because that shows you the existence of what's called ultraviolet divergences and infrared singularities, well, infrared divergences, which are something new in quantum theory with respect to quantum mechanics, and that's going to be very important for normalization. This leads to the theory of normalization. Okay, and then, if time, I'll start to discuss the interacting scalar 5-4 theory. Okay, so first, we have seen that we start from the free field with action is just S. So I'm going to consider just the Euclidean theory, so the integral over space-time of 1/2 of E mu phi squared plus n squared over 2 pi squared. This is the action. And I'm in the Euclidean setting. So then I don't have to take care of I, factor of I and signature of space-time. And we have seen that the two-point function, the propagator, phi of x1, phi of x2, is h-bar times the Green function of x1 minus x2, where this is just the Fourier transform k dot x of a Lorentzian, k squared plus m squared. Okay, so that's propagation. So that's the Euclidean propagator, and you have seen that if you perform a Wick rotation, you recover the Feynman propagator for X. Okay. So now, of course, we are interested in computing general correlation functions. Which are correspond to phi of x1 up to phi of xn in this framework. Okay? And that's important for many reasons. The main reason being that if you go to the real-time theory, this leads to construct the matrix element. The matrix elements of arbitrary a dagger operator applied to the vacuum. Because remember, in canonical quantization, the phi operator is just a linear combination of A and A dagger operator, so creation of annihilation operator of the mode of the field. And so you can rewrite this by using the commutation relation as if you go to through a weak rotation to the real-time theory, you can rewrite, you can re-express out of this products of A dagger zero. Okay. So you reconstruct the scalar product of a basis of the Fock space, of the Hilbert space of the theory. So out of this, you reconstruct the Hilbert space and the scalar product of the theory. So you reconstruct the quantum theory formulated in the canonical formalism out of the knowledge of all the correlation functions. Okay. Okay, so now, of course, Wick's theorem states that when you compute the expectation value of a product V by Xn, this is just given by the sum of all possible pairings of points, vertices, of the products of the pairs of the two-point function. So phi of x. So you can, for instance, order the points x1, xn into a1, b1, a2, b2, up to a, m, bm, plus n equal to m, and construct pair like that. And that's going to be product of the pair of xa, xb. So this is Wick's theorem, and it's valid for the free theory. Okay. So for instance, the four-point function so phi, let's call it phi of x1 up to phi of x4 is just given by the three different pairings. So it's given by phi of x1, phi of x2, times phi of x3, phi of x4, plus phi of x1, phi of x3, times phi of x2, phi of x4, plus phi of x1, phi of x4, times phi of x2, phi of x3. So there are three terms. Okay. And if you represent the two-point functions, so propagator phi of x, phi of x1, phi of x2, by just a line joining the point x1 and x2, then you get that the four-point function, which is an object where you have 1, 2, 3, 4, is represented by four vertices, is given by this diagram, plus this diagram, plus this diagram. Okay. So this is just a combinatorial, this formula is a combinatorial formulation. Okay. And this is the first example of the famous Feynman diagram representation for correlation functions. Okay. And well, I won't rederive this result in in this case, because I think you have seen this already, both in quantum theory and in statistical mechanics. But this big theorem comes out from the fact that the correlation functions are expectation of random variables, which are the field, in a theory where the phi are Gaussian random variables. So basically, it comes from the fact that phi of x1, phi of xn. So this is a functional integral staying in the Euclidean setting of phi of x1, phi of xn, normalized by d of phi, exponential minus 1 over se of phi. So if you are a mathematician, you say that this is just the expectation, this capital E is the expectation of phi of x1 times phi of xn, where phi is a Gaussian random variable, and the propagator phi of x1, phi of xn is just the two-point correlation, so the expectation is the value of the product of the two fields, so it's called the cumulant, the two-point cumulant. Okay, so this result is a general property of expectation value of products of Gaussian random variable. Okay, is it clear? Okay. So what's important is that we have a way to compute this easily. And this, the knowledge of all these correlation functions leads to, in fact, a way to reconstruct the Hilbert space of the theory out of the functional integral. And of course, when n is odd, this is zero. Zero. Simply, that's a consequence of the fact that the action is even when you change phi into minus phi. So it comes from the fact that if I change phi into minus phi, this is a symmetry of the theory, which ensures that odd correlation functions are zero. Okay. So now let's go back to the second point I want to discuss, which are what are the short distance and long distance property of the propagator. So first, I'm going to first maybe I can So again, I'm going to discuss this in the Euclidean setting, short distance properties. But it's going to be the same in the Euclidean setting. So maybe I can, okay, no, let's go back to that. So I'm still in the Euclidean setting. And remember, we have this formula. G of x is a Fourier transform of this object, the Lorentzian. We know that by rotational invariance, it's a function of the norm of the vector x. We are in Euclidean setting, so g of x is a function of g of x1, x2, is a function of the norm of x1 minus x2. And you may ask what's happening when x1 is very close to x2, so when this x is very small. And well, there are various ways to understand what's going on, but one way to see what's going on is to see that if x is very small, what's important in this integral is what's happening when k, x is over the one, so when k is large. And when k is large, you can neglect the mass term because k squared is much larger than m squared. So if we use the fact that g of x is integral, the Fourier transform of k squared plus m squared, if x is small, small means that in fact that x times m is much smaller than one because we have a unit of energy of inverse of mass, which is momentum, which is a mass. Then what counts in the integral is what happened when x times k is over the one. Therefore, we can neglect this. And we get an integral which is an homogeneous function of k. So we can rescale k into k divided by x. So why is that k is q divided by x, where q is another momentum. So this integral becomes, well, it's easy. You get x to the power 2 minus d times this integral, dd of k, e I q times some unit vector, in x space, divided by q squared. And this is just a number. Okay? So you see easily that by this just dimensional analysis argument, that this should scale like x1 minus x2 to the power 2 minus d, where d is a dimension of space, times some coefficients that I can call c of d coefficient. Okay. So, of course, this argument works if the dimension of space is larger than 2. Because this integral of a Q, I'm sorry, this is an integral of a Q. This integral of a Q, Q is now a vector. This integral of a Q will converge at infinity because you have an oscillating factor, which is sufficient to ensure convergence. And it's convergent at q equals zero if the dimension of space is larger than two. Because when you have an integral dq over q squared, this gives an integral over d of the norm of q if you go to radial coordinates, q d minus three. radial coordinates times some angular near zero. And this integral near zero converge if the dimension is larger than 2. So we are going to go back to that later. But the important result is this one. It says that at small distances, the propagator behaves like a power of the distance between the two points. And it's a power which is negative if the dimension is larger than 2. So you have this goes to infinity at short distance if the dimension is larger than 2. Okay. Well, if d equal 2, you have to work a bit more because you have a logarithmic divergence. You have d2q over q squared, so dq divided by q. So the integral is still divergence. So if d equal q, you have a log divergence. And with a bit of work, you found that g of x is just minus 1 over 2 pi log of the mass times the norm of x. Well, let me write the full factor plus a constant, which is Euler constant divided by 2p plus negligible term. So this is a number. This is called Euler constant. So there is a log. So both in dimension higher than 2 and in dimension 2, it's divergent. Okay. So what does this mean? It's something new, in fact, because it's new to quantum field theory. In quantum mechanics, you don't have those kind of singularity. Because in quantum mechanics, which means that when the dimension of space-time is 1, so you have only one time, but no space in the sense of space in which your quantum field lives, then, well, it's a calculation that you have probably done, but if you want to compute the propagator in quantum mechanics, d equals 1, this is just 1 over 2m exponential of minus m times x, the norm of x, the distance, it's the time, it's the Euclidean time, so it's finite at x equals 0. Yes?
Could you please explain why in quantum mechanics d is equal to 1? Or why this is equivalent to quantum mechanics?
I explained that last time, okay. But I can explain it again if you like.
It's going to take time.
What?
I can just rewatch it.
It's just that when you take the action here and the path integral, which is defined here, in one dimension you have just 1 dx, you have the derivative respect to x of phi plus m squared phi squared. So if you make the dictionary that in quantum mechanics you have x, which is a vector, is just a one component vector. So it's just coordinates, which is Euclidean time. And if you rewrite phi of, so phi of x, you rewrite it as q of t, position of the particle. Then the action of the field becomes just the action of a particle. This is the kinetic term with mass one in an harmonic potential. So you get a particle of mass one in a harmonic potential. So usually the harmonic potential is 1/2 of omega q squared with omega equals the mass of the field. It's omega squared. I'm sorry. Yeah, so omega is the mass of the field. So you have a dictionary between quantum field theory in one dimension and quantum mechanics in one dimension. But the dictionary is that the time, the position becomes time, the field becomes the position, and the mass of the field becomes the frequency or the pulsation of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, so okay, so this is something very new. That's a fundamental property of quantum field theory, that in a, for a quantum relativistic field, when you quantize it at short distance, correlation function of field operator are singular. Okay. So you have short distance singularities. Okay. And in particular, this implies something which is very important. What is, so it means that g of zero, so the green function at zero distance, it should correspond to the expectation value of the field operator squared at any point. And this is infinite. While, of course, in quantum mechanics, if you want to define the operator q squared, you have no problem. Here, q squared is finite. Okay. So products of fields operator are something non-trivial. Products at equal points, so both position and time of field operator. And in fact, it's general for any operator, are problematic. It's a problematic issue. You have to understand what's going on in the theory to see whether you can define those operators. Okay. So that's a question. So it turns out that this question, this issue, is both important, but it's a solution of the problem. We see out that the existence of short distance singularity is an essential property of quantum field theory, because it's this existence of those singularities that allows to, you know, restore the causal structure of a quantum field theory and through the theory of renormalization. So this is the question, and the answer is renormalization theory. So I'm going to try to persuade you on some simple example later that, in fact, you know, the problem contains its own solution. it took a few decades to theoretical physicists to understand what it is, but that's one of the most beautiful features of quantum theory. Okay, so before doing that, I'm going to discuss where those short distance singularity comes from in the framework of the path integral, of the functional integral. So the short distance singularity means that in fact, you know, the path integral corresponds to making a probabilistic average over field configuration. So of course at Euclidean time, the Euclidean framework, space time, the functional integral means to make a probabilistic average over the space, the probabilistic space of field conjugation. So you have a probabilistic space in the sense of probability theory, which is a space of field configuration, which is, can be defined by the Kolmogorov axiom in the theory of probability. So mathematicians have a well-defined formalism to define that. And you have a measure, a probability measure on this field of configuration, and you make average with this probability measure on the field of configuration. And so the here, simply, the probability measure, so the field configuration is a space of phi properly defined, and the field, the probability measure is d phi times the exponential of minus the action. Okay. And so you may ask, how is it that you have a configuration space of field configuration, which is such that while you take average of products of field at different points, or value of this random variable at different points, you get finite result. So you expect that phi is finite. But when you take the average of the square of the value of the field at one point, it's infinite, which seems to suggest that the value of the field at any point is infinite. So how is it possible that you have a field whose value at any point is infinite, while when you take average of products at different time or different, you get a finite result? Okay, and the answer is that. So why? So what does this mean? The answer is that in fact, in dimensions larger or equal to 2, the probabilistic space is not a space of a field configuration in the space of function. It's an average over distribution. So the field phi x is a random distribution. And you know, well, distribution are a tool that has been invented by a mathematician, especially by a French mathematician called Laurent Schwartz, to make sense of this horrible object that physicists had been using since several decades, which are the delta function. So the delta function, think about the delta, the Dirac delta function. This is an example of a function which is zero everywhere except at one point when it's infinite. Okay. And that's the simplest example of a distribution which is now perfectly well understood. But you can think about what's happening when you have functions which are a random collection of delta functions. And then you can introduce correlation between the delta, between the value of the delta function at a different point. And out of that, you can build what's called this free field. Okay. So, in fact, the random distribution which is present here is what mathematicians called, now mathematicians call this object the Gaussian free field. or GFF. And although this object is, of course, well known from physicists and from mathematicians in analysis since the 50s, in fact, the mathematician in probability theory started to be interested about 20 years ago about this object viewed from the point of view of probability theory, and they made a lot of studies and a lot of discoveries. And they found some fascinating properties of this object which had not been, well, some were known from physicists and mathematicians interested in quantum field theory, but some were new. Okay, so this is an active field, still an active field in mathematics, in probability theory. And physicists came interested again in that, in this subject, motivated by what the mathematicians were doing. Okay, so what I want to show you is just to show you some pictures. I want to show you some picture of what a typical sample of a Gaussian free field looks like when you try to study this average of a configuration of free field. And for this, I would need the projector, I think. Thank you. Maybe one can switch down a bit the light, or it's automatic. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to show you some sample, and they have been obtained by a very simple, Mathematica program. So you can do this by yourself. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to take a lattice. We show that we can define properly the path integral, the functional integral on a lattice. I'm going to take a lattice. So lattice means that I'm dealing with the Euclidean quantum field theory. I'm going to take a lattice which is periodic in all directions. That's the simplest case. It's a finite lattice. It's periodic. And what I'm going to do is that I'm going to show you sample of the field you integrate over and see how, on a finite lattice, of course, everything is finite because you have no infinite, infinitely small distance. You have a minimal mesh distance between two different fields, so everything is finite. But what's interesting is see how the field configuration looks like when you take the continuum limit. So when you take the mesh of the lattice becoming smaller and smaller. So I'm going to compare a big lattice, and this I have a random field phi. And with a lattice which is twice smaller and then much more smaller, etc. And without changing anything else in the, so I'm not changing the action, I'm just changing the mesh. So it corresponds to some kind of renormalization, as you have seen in the statistical mechanics course. I'm taking a limit where the mesh goes to zero. Okay. So, of course, when I was following your question, we have seen that in one dimension of space-time, so that's a one-dimensional field. In fact, this corresponds to a quantum particle moving a long time, and in Euclidean time, this is a typical configuration. So they are different, the color different samples of the same distribution. Where here, this is not really periodic. Here, this is time. Okay, and this goes from 1 to 15,000. So it's quite a big mesh, and I introduce a constraint that the particle is at zero at initial time. and at zero, both at zero at final time. So it's a real propagator between. So this is a random variable, but in probability theory, it says that you have a random variable, but it's conditioned to be at the origin, at the initial time, and at the origin, at the final time. So this is time, and this is a field or the position of the particle. And despite this, you see that if you follow a typical configuration, let's for instance the green one, which is visible, you see that a typical history of the particle is a continuous function, but it oscillates widely. And that's because it's a Brownian path. It's a Brownian walk. So it's a continuous walk, but everywhere its velocity, its derivative is infinite. It goes from minus infinity to plus infinity very, very quickly, so that on the average, there is a drift velocity, which is finite, but the instant velocity is zero. Okay? And this comes from the fact that if you want to measure what is the average velocity of the field, you find that the fact that there is an absolute value of x makes when you take the second derivative of absolute value of x, this is a Dirac function. Okay. So even in one dimension, so below this threshold, the field configuration are somehow wild. They are continuous, so they are well-defined function in the sense of mathematics, but still, they are function with no derivative. Well, now mathematicians and physicists are very used to that. But now, what's going on when you go to two dimensions? So this is a sample of a Gaussian free field, you know, chosen at random. That's one point in the configuration space of old field configuration, weighted with a correct probability distribution for functional integral. But that's on a small lattice. So it's a 64 by, so we are in two dimensions. We have taken a 64 by 64 lattice. So the lattice is periodic in this direction. So this the field here, and check is equal to the field here. And you see that it looks like a two-dimensional random walk. So it's a field which seems continuous, but it has oscillation. What's interesting, what's happening when you refine the mesh? So if you go from 64 to 120 high, okay, you see that it becomes more spiky. Is it spiky or spiky?
Spiky.
It becomes more spiky, in fact. While, in fact, for a random walk, it doesn't become more spiky. So it becomes quite spiky. We are still a function. And when you go to a larger lattice, it becomes very spiky. And if you go to even a larger lattice, it starts to be big. It's become very spiky. And if you go on, it becomes more and more spiky. And you see, the typical eight of the distribution at one point measures, roughly speaking, this. You have a spiky configuration like that, very spiky, and at one point, the typical eights measure the square root of the value absolute of phi of x plus the mesh epsilon. So the smaller the mesh, the larger the eight, because this is going to infinity. Yes?
Is the vertical scale in all these pictures the same, or is it changing?
I'm sorry?
Is the vertical scale the same for each method?
Of course, otherwise I would have cheated. Yes, yes, yes. No, of course, that's the same scale. Yeah, I've not written the scale. Well, the scale is written, but in a very small letter. No, well, I did that a few years ago, so I should check. Yes, I didn't. No, I didn't cheat it, of course. Okay, so now you can do the same in three dimension. So in three dimension, of course, it's more difficult to represent a sample configuration of a field defined in space. So this is just a two-dimensional section of a random field defined on inside a cube with periodic boundary conditions. So it's a two-dimensional section of a Gaussian free field in a three-dimensional on a three-dimensional lattice. Again, this is a small lattice. Larger lattice. And if you compare with the two-dimensional case, so then you start to have to measure, you realize that this field is much, much, much more spiky than in two dimensions. So the spikiness, if you want, of the random field configuration, of the sample of field, increases with the dimension. Okay, and that's because, as we have seen here, the divergence is stronger in three dimensions than in two dimensions. In two dimensions, it's a log. In three dimensions, it's 1/(distance). And in four dimensions, it's going to be 1/√(√). So one important thing that I should write here is that the higher the dimension, or larger the dimension, dimension of space-time, the higher the singularity, or the stronger the singularities are. And that's also an important feature. Okay, I think I can stop here for this. So can you? Thank you. Anyway, in the lecture notes, you will find those pictures. And it's a good exercise to write a program to get samples of this Gaussian distribution. Since it's a Gaussian random variables, you have well-defined packages to construct, Gaussian distribution. Okay, but so, an important point is that in dimension higher than 2 or equal to 2, you have those short distance singularities. And the higher the dimension, the stronger the singularity are. And this fact is just, given by dimensional analysis. If you go back to the action, the action should be something, or in fact, the action divided by h bar should be a dimensionless object. So if you think about what is the dimension, the engineering dimension of the field in the theory, if this is dimensionless, this, of course, the volume term has a dimension of a length to the power d. The derivative has the dimension of a length to the power minus 2. So the engineering dimension of the field let's call it, bracket phi. This has dimension of a length to the power 2 minus d divided by 2. Just very standard dimensional analysis. So the smaller the length, the higher the dimension. Well, so the smaller the length, the bigger the field is if d is less than 2. So the fact that there are divergence is that the dimension of the length, the dimension of the field is negative. while for D less than 2, it's positive. Okay. So if you want, you can write the dimension of the field like delta of phi, and this is 2 minus D over 2. Okay. And we are going to meet this dimension of the field when discussing renormalization. So keep this formula. It's going to be very important. Okay. So this is the origin of the four-distance singularity in a quantum field theory. And it's very generic. Okay? So now I think I can, let me come back to one last point. First I have to discuss, let me first discuss the infrared divergence. So let me discuss, let me discuss the Liouville of the propagator. So I start from this expression. And I'm interested in what's happening when x is large. Which means that x times m is much, much larger than 1, instead of being much smaller than 1. Okay. Then, there are different ways to see the property of this, but I think you have discussed, this has been discussed in quantum, in statistical physics course, but the result is that when there is a mass, if the mass term is positive, then g of x behaves like exponential minus m times x. So you have an exponential decay. It's exponential because I'm in the Euclidean regime. In the Minkowski regime, if x is time, this is oscillating. Okay. And you can see that in different ways. You can, then you cannot neglect, of course, m, but you can, deform integration contour for k in complex plane and to pick up the poles at k equal plus or minus im. So this comes from the fact that the propagator has a pole at k equal plus or minus im. K is the Euclidean momentum. You can also view that by remembering that g of x is just the inverse of the quadratic form in the action. So it's a solution of minus delta plus m squared g of x equal delta of x. And if you go to large distance, you can forget this. So this is zero. And so using the fact that g is a function which is invariant under rotation, this becomes minus d over d squared over dr squared plus d minus 1 over r d over dr of g of r equals 0. Plus m squared. G or r equals 0, where r is just the absolute value of x. Okay. Okay, and when you are at large distance, you can, this term is negligible with respect to this one. So this obeys exponential minus d squared over dr squared plus m squared of g of r equals zero. So g of r behaves like exponential plus or minus mr. And of course, since the propagator has to decrease at large distance, it cannot grow at large distance. This is a minus. Okay. So the important point is that there's an exponential decay in Euclidean, an oscillating behavior in the time region in the Minkowski space-time. So this is valid in Euclidean and in space region in Minkowski. Okay. So the behavior is quite under control. So this is for the massive theory. Okay. Now, there might be a problem for the massless theory. Okay. Because for the massless theory, there is no mass. So, in fact, the result that I wrote here is exact. G of x must be an algebraic power of x, because there is no mass to change this behavior. So the massless theory, in the massless theory, we know G of x. G of x is x to the power 2 minus d times this coefficient C of d. Okay, and this coefficient C of d, well, there is an explicit formula, if you like, but we have seen that C of d is well-defined. C of d is finite if the dimension of space is larger than 2. Okay, I can give you the expression in d, well, in d equal 3, this is 1 over 4 pi. This is just the coefficient of the Coulomb potential. In three dimensions, the green function is the Coulomb formula, the Coulomb potential. Okay, in four dimensions, this is 1 over 4 times pi squared, etc. In a four dimensions. Okay. But, so, things are under control. This is exact. This is exact. You have no other terms. It's a pure power. And that's because the free field, massless field, is what is called scale invariant. In that case, you have no mass term in the action. So if you change the distance, if you rescale the distance, you can rescale the field according to its scaling dimension, and you don't change the action. You see? So the massless field has an additional symmetry. It has Poincaré. Plus scale or dilatation, scale. In space, you can rescale the distance. Okay. And in fact, it turns out that it has an additional symmetry, which makes it what's called a conformal theory. We are going to go back to that when discussing renormalization. But in fact, it means that not only if you change the distance by a lambda times 6, a scaling factor everywhere, but if you change x into x divided by norm of x, this is also a symmetry, a bit strange, inversion. So instead of having a Poincaré group, which is already a big group, you have a much, much bigger group of symmetry, of space-time symmetry, which mixes the field and the transformation, non-linear, linear and non-linear transformation on the field. Okay, let's stop that. Okay. So now, of course, what remains to understand is what's happening two dimension. In two dimension, we have seen that the propagator, where is it written, gives like log of m divided by x. So g of x gives like minus 1 over 2 pi log of m times x plus subdominant term. But when m goes to 0, this is problematic. There is a new divergence, which is called an infrared divergence. I'm not sure I stated the name, but these short distance singularity are of course called also ultraviolet. This is an infrared. Infrared because it's short, large distance, therefore short wavelengths, short moment. Okay. New infrared divergence, which appears in two dimensions. Okay. And these are physical. Two. We have seen that the origin of those singularities at short distance comes from the, you know, the structure of the field in the path integral, in the random, in the average over field configuration. That comes from the dimension of the field. The infrared divergence comes also from the dimension of the field. They come from the fact that in two dimensions, the dimension of the field is a length to the power of zero. In fact, it has the dimension of a log of a length, and therefore there are singularities both when the distance, the length is very large, and when the length is very small. Okay. Well, they mean that in fact the concept of a free, non-interacting massless field, scalar field, in two dimension is not well, is problematic. Yeah. And this is related to something that I presume you have seen in statistical mechanical course, an example of massless fields that appears. So massless excitation in statistical models in two dimensions occurs when you have Goldstone modes. So soft modes or spin waves modes that appears in a system which has a continuous symmetry which is spontaneously broken. Okay, and Goldstone modes are associated to spontaneous breaking of continuous symmetry, like a rotational U1 symmetry, SU2 symmetry, O3 symmetry, that's abounds in condensed matter system. But two dimension, there is a problem in having a continuous symmetry which is spontaneously broken. So I'm probably going to go back when I'll discuss renormalization, because that's an important issue. But you have to keep in mind that in dimension higher than 2 in a quantum field theory, you have ultraviolet divergences. And for a massless theory, you have in dimension less or equal to 2, because it goes in the opposite way. You have infrared divergences, okay? Okay. Yes?
But it seems like that the divergence also happens if we have a mass different from zero, right?
No, because log of x times m is well defined for x different. So that's for x different from zero.
Yeah, so it's really...
So the propagator as a function of x becomes singular when the theory is massless. It blows up, you know, for all value of x. It's not well defined.
But also when x is really, really large, the log diverges, right?
Yes, even there. Because in fact, there is... you see, it's a log. This is an exact... Now, if you take the propagator for x large, but finite compared to m, no, yeah. So if you take the propagator here, in this case, when you take x fixed and let m go to zero, then you know, mx at some points becomes small. Mm-hmm. So this, you cannot trust this anymore. So this divergence occurs for fixed x, m goes to zero. And the propagator as a function of x diverge for any value of x. So in two dimension, we expect that we can construct a theory of non-interacting field if they are massive. But if the field becomes massless, the theory is problematic. And you can view that when you try to construct it also in the canonical formalism. You have some states that becomes, which have a norm that becomes infinite, I think, something like that. So it's a problem which appears also in canonical quantization.
But, my question, yeah, I understand that, but why do we call it an infrared divergence? Because, like, if the mass is going to zero,
yes,
then it doesn't matter if x is big or small.
Yeah, but it comes from the fact that when you go to this integral, you see, if the mass is zero, this integral diverges when k equals zero. So it comes from the small k. So the denomination that is five, it becomes equal. It comes from k small in the Fourier transform. So it comes from the soft modes. So hence the denomination. Thank you for the question. Okay. So Okay, so now either I start to discuss the interacting scalar field, but I'm not sure I will go far. So maybe I should better start tomorrow and continue to discuss a little bit. That's going to be important also in the rest of the course, and that's something that you should know. I'm going back to the short distance. So we have seen that there are infrared divergences. The dimension of the series space is less or equal to 2. We have shown that we have ultraviolet singularities at short distances when d larger or equal to 2. So ultraviolet singularity means that the theory makes sense, but that's the two-point function, so some observable of the theory becomes singular at short distance. So this is divergence because it's a problem in defining the theory. Those are singularity because those are divergence in some of the operator or object you can construct in the theory. Yes?
Is there a distinction with the mass being 0 due to our divergence?
What do you mean by?
Does the mass have to be 0 for this R divergence to occur?
The mass has to be equal to 0. As long as the mass is non-zero, you have no infrared divergence. Okay. It's when the mass is strictly equal to 0. The mass has to be strictly. Because it's when the mass is 0 that you have those additional symmetries, for instance. Okay, so now let me come back to this, and I'm going to introduce in 15 minutes just a word about something which turns out to be very, very important in quantum field theory. That's the concept of products of operators. Local operators. And that's very important because that's one of the most important tools in quantum field theory, which is called Wilson's operator product expansion. OPE. And I'm going to give a very simple example just for the free theory. So we have seen that phi of x is well defined in so you can compute correlation function of phi of x, and by your correspondence principle, it should correspond to the field operator that I denote capital phi of x in the canonical formalism. Okay. But we have seen that phi squared of x is infinite. So if you want to compute naively the products of two field operators at the same point, by the functional integral formalism, you get something which is always infinite. Okay. So the question is, can we construct something which is finite and which corresponds to some operator analog of phi of x squared, so the product two times the field operator applied to the vacuum at a given point in the canonical formalism. And I'm going to show you how you can construct five x times five x. And in fact, the recipe is quite simple, but important. So let's consider phi of x, phi of y, let me consider a correlation function with n plus 2 points. Okay? And that's given by a Feynman diagram. It's given by a sum through Wick theorem. Okay. Now I isolate the first two points that I have called x and y to make them different from z1, zn. Okay? And I want to see what's happening when x, when y goes to x. If y is equal to x, then I get phi square of x, and I know this is infinite. But it's interesting to see how this is infinite. Because if you consider a function like that, you see, let me draw like that. Let me draw the set of Feynman diagrams. You have my two points x, y, and then I have my point z1, z2, up to zn. Okay, so this is a sum of diagram. This is given by the sum of products of propagator associated to pairings. And you have two kinds of pairings. First, you have the pairing where x is paired with y. See, so you have a diagram where x is paired to y. And then you have the other ones which are paired together in all possible ways. Okay? And then you have the diagram where x is not paired to y, but paired with one of the z's. But the other ways. And y is paired to another z. You see? So here you have a double factorial of n terms, and here you have, you choose, and then you pair the other one. You see? And those two classes of diagrams are very different because the singularity is here. This is singular when x goes to y. This is y, but this is regular when x goes to y, because you have two propagators, but you have no propagator between x and y. Okay. So now, think about what is this first term. This first term is just the two-point function between x and y. So this gives g of x minus y. So let me write it like phi of x, phi of y, times the sum of the products of propagator for all pairings between z1 and zn. So this is just the correlation function between phi at point z1 up to phi at point zn. So So it is this correlation function where you have removed phi, the two first phi. Okay? And this term, the sum of these terms, is something which is regular. You see? So it's a difference between this and this. So let me just call it, that's a definition. The normal product, let me use a red dot. So this is an object which is called the normal product. Normal product of two operators times phi of z1 zn. So it's just a definition. Here you take it as a definition. So this is equal to this plus the difference, which I called normal product. So take it as a definition. As a formal definition. Okay? Okay. But now the relation between this correlation function, these products of two correlation functions, and this object, this definition is irrespective of how many phi you put here. So this definition is valid independently of the z1, zn inserted. You can put as many phi you like at any arbitrary point, provided that they do not coincide with x and y. Okay, and I explained in the first section of the book, I can use the last blackboard here. Okay, so I explained in the beginning of the course that in fact, out of the correlation function, you can construct all the matrix element of the operator of the series. So you can construct all the operator of the series. So since this relation is valid, whichever phi operator you insert here in this expectation value, you can write this definition, which is formal, as a definition of an operator of the series. So this can be extended. Into the definition of a new operator. So, in fact, this is an operator of the series. It's an observable. And what is the definition? Is that the normal product of the product of two operators at two coinciding points x and y? This is defined by the ordinary products of the two operators. Minus these terms. And these terms is just, well, same thing here than here, times a number. But what is it to multiply a product of operator by a number? It's just multiplied this product of operator by a very specific operator, a trivial operator, which is the identity operator. So minus the identity operator times the function phi of x1, phi of x, phi of y. The two-point function times the times the identity. And let me write this I of x, for instance, or I of x plus y divided by 2. So this is the identity operator. And you can insert the identity operator everywhere because it doesn't change anything. And this is a number, a function of x and y. This is an operator. This is an operator. You see? It's an observable of the theory. Yes?
So, sorry, 5x1, 5xn, should that be 5x and 5? What you've written here, should that be 5x, 5y?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you. Typo for mine. Yes?
What do you mean by x plus y over 2?
It's just the middle point.
Oh, it's the argument of the identity.
Yeah. You can say that the identity is an operator, and you can say that you insert the identity at some point here. But since it doesn't change, it's the same operator. It's just a convenient notation. Okay. And now, if you are interested in what is the expectation value of this new operator, phi of x, phi of y, with phi of z1, phi of zn, it's this. So it's this minus this. So it's given by sum over all pairings, but the pairing xy excluded. And then you have products of two-point function of the series. Okay. And now, the point is that in this definition, you can let x goes to y, or y goes to x. So the limit of phi of x, phi of y, when y goes to x, which I can denote phi of x squared, normal product of phi of x, exists as an operator. Because then phi of x squared, the normal product of phi of x squared by phi of z1, phi of zn. This is given by sum over all pairings. So now you have x equal y. You can pair x with y, and x here, and x and y, but no x equal y pairing allowed. Okay. So it exists as an operator. And now it's local. So this is a way, so this, which is a normal product of phi of x times phi of x, is well defined as an operator through its Feynman rules, because we're in quantum field theory. So phi square of x is infinite, but when you subtract this dangerous term, it's well defined. So the ultraviolet, the short distance divergence in this product of operator is entirely contained in a local term proportional to the identity. That's it. So we subtract the identity, the term, by a counter times times an operator. So it's a first example, first simple example of renormalization. We change the definition of the operator products of two fields by removing the dangerous term, and we get something which is finite and which is non-trivial, because its correlation function with point, you know, depends on the respective position of x with respect to z1 up to zn, so it's a non-trivial operator, you see? And it's a new operator, it's a new local operator of the theory. It is new. Okay. And so, well, this game can be repeated. I won't do that. You can define the product of three operator or four operator. You can define the product at equal point of two normal products of operator. So this the game go on. Goes on, and you can define normal products of phi to the p operator at a point x. And I'd rather should rewrite this as normal products of phi squared located at point x, because this is the operator, and this is the location of the operator. So this is a better notation. That's a double dot product of phi squared times at located at point x. Okay, so phi squared of x is well defined. It is local, and it is a new operator of the theory that we have constructed in this way. Okay, and now, what you can see, if you go back to this operator, phi of x, phi of y, you can rewrite this. Let's insert this. You see? Let's invert that. Let me write the product of the two operators phi of x, phi of y. This is given by this dangerous term, which is c of d x minus y to the power 2 minus d plus subdominant term, which is a function. Okay, times the identity operator, I of x plus y divided by 2. This is a local operator. Okay, plus phi of x, phi of y. But this is an operator. This operator is given by sum of those objects where x and y don't interact with each other. So you can expand that in power of x and y. You can make a local, a Taylor expansion when x and y are different. So you can rewrite this as plus the normal product of phi squared at the point, well, let me write this x plus y divided by 2. This is an operator. Plus terms in the standard Taylor expansion. Of phi of x, phi of y. Okay. So you have term of order x minus y squared, x minus y 4, x minus y 6, etc. But they are all regular. So you can write the product of those two operators, which become singular when x goes to y, times a different function times the identity operator, plus a well-defined operator, I'm sorry if you don't see that, plus higher order term. Okay. So this is the first example of what is called the expansion of the products of those two operators into a series of local operators with coefficients which may contain divergent term. You see? So this is the first example of one of those famous Wilson operator products expansion, which means expansion of local products of operator in terms of series of local operators. Okay. And you'll meet later and in courses in conformal physics, in string theory, the fact that in general, when you have a general QFT, you have a lot of sets of operators, local operators, that we let call it A of X, well, AI, let's call them OI of X, where I are labels for operators. Okay, and in general, when you have two operators, O1 of X and O of 2 of Y, and when X goes to Y, you can write this as a sum over some coefficient I of OI of X plus Y divided by 2, those are operators, times coefficient of X plus Y of X minus Y. And this coefficient, in fact, you know, is, you know, depends on the operator 1 and 2 and on the operator I. Because you can take any operator, let's call it G and K. And this is going to be GK. Where this is a function. And these are operators. And these functions contain the short distance singularity. And the case that written explicitly here is a case where I have one, my first operator O0 is the identity. My second operator O1 is phi. My third operator is the normal products of the square, the normal products of phi squared. And the first term here is C011. So this is C0. What I'm writing is that O1, O1 is C110, O0, where this is the identity, this is O1, O1, plus C112, O2. And this coefficient is just X minus Y, well, let's get X1, X1, what's X minus Y to the power 2 minus D, and this coefficient is just 1. So this is singular. This is finite. Okay. Okay, so let me, I already spent too much time. Let me end that, but I think it's important that you have seen this concept of operator product expansion and the definition of products of local operator by this kind of procedure at the level of free field, because that's the simplest example where everything can be worked out. Okay? Thank you. And sorry for being late.